The very first speaker today, I'm just looking for my glasses, and that's one of the hard things in this world, is Gillian Triggs, who, as you know, because you need the program, you can read all about her in the program, but is now the Dean of Law School at the University of Sydney. And she told me just now that she went to the Antarctic first time, maybe the only time, in 1986. So she among the many of us here who have been to the Antarctic. And her title is different in her abstract, in her talk, and the way I understand it, even her talk will be slightly different for what's in the program, which is that she's going to talk on perspectives on Antarctic claimant and non-claimant nations, but the word before perspectives is perhaps not going to be as much historic as it's going to be legal. And that, I think, will make an interesting issue also in the afternoon. We will have some further comments on that. But, Gillian, it's my great pleasure now to give you the floor, and we look forward to hearing you as the first talk of this session.
Thank you very much, and good morning, everybody. I'm absolutely delighted to be with you today. I have come from a rather long distance from Australia, but it's always fascinating how immediately one is friends re-establishes friendships with people that I've known in the Antarctic field as a lawyer since the early 80s when I first started my research into the legal aspects. So it's wonderful to see so many of you here and to realise that that Antarctic community continues to do its work. I've been asked to talk about the legal and historical aspects of the Antarctic Treaty. And I was very interested by His Serene Highness's comment that Antarctica is a continent in a state of alert. I think he's right, and I think it should be a continent in a state of alert, because there are various challenges in the 21st century that I think we need to be aware of and to learn from the past in order to ensure that the responses are appropriate. Today's session is largely about the origin, evolution, and resilience of the Antarctic Treaty, and that really is what I wanted to talk about. Of course, from a legal perspective, law is merely a tool, a means by which one can facilitate achievement of broader objectives, and that is how I see law, and certainly how I see public international law. So perhaps I can make the first point, and that we are, after all, here to celebrate 50 years. The Antarctic Treaty system of interlinked conventions, measures, and recommendations founded on the Antarctic Treaty has proved to be one of the successes of 20th century international law and diplomacy. For the last 50 years, a tenth of the Earth has been regulated peacefully and in the interest of scientific research. Negotiated, as has been observed, during the Cold War, the treaty ensured that potential conflict over the seven largely unrecognized and disputed claims to territorial sovereignty has been avoided. Indeed, I was pleased to be in the United States and to refer to that great American international lawyer, Philip Jessop, who argued before the U.S. Senate Committee on Foreign Relations in 1960 that the importance of the Antarctic Treaty lies in the fact that it will permit the last great empty continent from becoming an international bone of contention, a scene of controversy and actual fighting. Well, the Antarctic Treaty system has achieved this and much more. It's become a model for regional environmental management founded upon the precepts of free scientific research and peaceful purposes. It was negotiated by 12 states, of which seven claimed rights as territorial sovereigns, at a time when there were as few as 55 states in the international community as a whole. Today, it might be questioned whether the 192 states that are now members of the United Nations are in any way legally bound by such a grandiose gesture that purported over 50 years ago to regulate activities on the largest continent on Earth. But as many of you here will know, the life of the law lies in experience, for in fact the Antarctic Treaty has withstood the tests of time and political, technological and economic change. It now has 46 members representing 80% of the world's population, but only 25% of the world's nation states. The Articles of the Antarctic Treaty, a model of elegant simplicity, have ensured that the world's largest, coldest, driest and most inhabitable inhospitable continent has been preserved. and an understanding of the contribution of Antarctica to the global climate system is now recognised as vital, and the culture of free exchange of scientific data has, for example, facilitated unprecedented cooperation in understanding the causes of the ozone hole and the melting of glaciers. Lawrence Gould, whose picture, or reference to him, is in this picture with us, claimed that the Antarctic Treaty is unique in history, which may take its place alongside the Magna Carta and other great symbols of man's quest for enlightenment and order. Well, such hyperbole on the 50th anniversary of the treaty prompts reflections upon the reasons for its successes as a regime for governance under international law. How is it that seven states that claim traditional sovereignty rights have worked broadly effectively with 21 other consultative parties to create a relatively comprehensive and effective system of Antarctic governance? The answer, and you won't be surprised that a lawyer should emphasise this point, is that the concept of sovereign neutrality was developed as the glue that binds the regime by sidestepping potential conflicts over territorial claims, enabling consultative parties to manage the activities in the wider community interests. I'd like to consider then the vital question for the 21st century, whether the treaty system is capable of responding effectively to the challenges posed by illegal, unreported and unregulated fishing and whaling, climate change that we've heard a little bit about already, commercial, particularly seaborne tourism, and concerns for energy and human security. The litigation in a recent whaling case brought by the Humane Society International in the Australian Federal Court will be examined very briefly by me as a salutary warning of the risks to the Antarctic Treaty system of unilateral assertions of national jurisdiction over activities within the area of the Antarctic Treaty. The consultative parties then are on notice to justify the legitimacy of their mandate and to demonstrate the capacity of the Antarctic Treaty system to respond to contemporary Antarctic issues, hence my noting the comment that Prince Albert has made that the continent is and should be in a state of alert. Well, the history, I was asked to speak a little bit about the history, and to those who are new to the Antarctic Treaty system, it may seem unnecessarily ambiguous, contrived, and suboptimal. But a moment's reflection on the history of the evolution of the regime explains its structure, procedures, and limitations. Indeed, I think it's really hard to overstate the importance of this, the technique adopted of sovereign neutrality that has made this system work. The historical background illumines the dynamic evolutionary nature of the legal regime that has responded and demonstrated an ability to respond to diverse political, economic, and resource priorities. The treaty was negotiated, as I've said, during the Cold War, completed shortly after Castro took over Havana. It survived efforts to open it up for mineral exploitation. It's been on the agenda of the UN General Assembly for over 30 years, but as you will doubtless know, it was removed from the agenda as recently as 2006. Antarctica has been the subject of calls for it to be declared a world park and adopted as the common heritage of mankind. Along the way, and in dealing with all of these issues, the evolving system has told us a great deal about effective international governance in the face of apparently insurmountable legal obstacles. The early 20th century negotiating history of the Antarctic regime reflected the predominant concerns of the claimant states and those conducting exploratory and scientific research activities to protect their interests. And one has to, of course, see the history of Antarctica in those terms. The claims to sovereignty over sectors in Antarctica have been made by seven states. I won't repeat those, but they've done so on the absolutely traditional bases of public international law of discovery, occupation, and geographical proximity. Of these claimants, only five mutually recognize the claims of the others. Overwhelmingly, the international community has either objected to the claims, ignored them, or made the point that Antarctica is not amenable to traditional concepts of territorial sovereignty. While by the 1940s, the United States and Soviet Union made the most extensive commitment of resources to Antarctic research and exploration, neither had made a claim to sovereignty, but each reserved the right to do so in the future. Other states, such as Belgium, Japan, and South Africa, had historical and research interests in Antarctica and sought to ensure a role in determining the future governance. India, Brazil, Uruguay, and Peru had also expressed interests, but were not ultimately to be included in negotiations. But it was clear, certainly from the early 40s, that Antarctica was somewhat unstable, and the media wrote frequently of the notion of the scramble for Antarctica, picking up the language, of course, of the scramble for the African subcontinent in the early 19th century. Indeed, it's interesting that Britain, Chile, and Argentina adopted a policy of barring naval demonstrations and maneuvers below the 60-degree south parallel in order to reduce what they saw as rising temperatures from potential conflicts. The first proposal to consider some form of international regulation was made by Norway in 1934, a planned conference being cancelled with the threat of war. Further proposals were then made for internationalization, particularly using Chapter 12 of the UN Charter, some form of UN trusteeship. The first glimmerings of the precepts on which the Antarctic Treaty System came to be founded were proposed in 1939 by Professor Julio Escudo, an international lawyer from Chile, who argued that any international agreement should not prejudice sovereign rights in Antarctica, that territorial claims should be frozen through a moratorium, and that scientific cooperation should be ensured. He addressed the sovereignty issue by arguing that any agreement should provide that activities south of 60 degrees south latitude should not prejudice sovereign rights. With the end of the Second World War came renewed attempts to seek a solution, and the driving force for negotiation again lay predominantly in the protection of national interests. But interestingly, President Eisenhower, among others, well understood that it was science that could well be the tool of diplomacy in achieving the outcome of preserving the interests that were seen to be at risk. In addition to the support amongst the scientific community for free access to Antarctica, there were wider internationalist objectives of non-government organizations, diplomats, and private citizens. In fact, in reading around this area and trying to find some photographs of the people involved, it seemed to me there were so few women. But I did find, in December 1947, petitions by the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom urging the UN to create a committee to take control of both the Arctic and the Antarctic, an idea that perhaps has yet to find its time. But in 1948, the United States proposed some form of internationalization, and it was then that it struck the legal positions of the major interested parties that have remained significantly unchanged. The proposal was rejected by Chile on the basis of its full and absolute sovereignty. The US proposal also prompted the Soviet Union to gather together its geographical society, which resolved in 1949 that the Soviet Union had irrefutable rights to participate in the solution of the problems of the Antarctic. New Zealand at that time was actually quite open to the idea of some form of world territory, but others such as Australia and the United Kingdom were deeply concerned about any such idea. They were also concerned that there should be any form of permanent secretariat or organizational structure, ideas that won't be at all unusual for you to be familiar or be thinking about today. It's also interesting that in 1955, the United Kingdom attempted to go before the International Court of Justice to resolve the overlapping claims by it and Chile and Argentina, but again, that effort was failed. So, the juridical battle lines were drawn by the mid-1950s. But the International Geophysical Year, as you all know, from July 57 to December 58, provided a new impetus and a new opportunity to reconsider how the future of Antarctica might be governed. In particular, of course, there were states concerned, Australia, for example, that the bases that were established during the International Geophysical Year would never be capable of being removed as a political matter. And therefore, the claimant states were forced into some kind of reappraisal and rethinking of the nature of their arrangement. But it was also interesting that in the mid-50s, at an IGY conference in Paris, there was a gentleman's agreement that they would conduct their work in the International Geophysical Year and not engage in legal or political argumentation. Well, as a lawyer, an agreement of that kind, of course, has very doubtful legal validity, but it was an idea that fell on fertile ground. And the United States then took up the initiative in 1958, adopting a strategy that's been described as quiet, confidential, and informal with interested states. It was then that the United States suggested or invited the 11 states with a direct interest in Antarctica to attend a conference here in Washington in October 1958. And those states were, of course, the seven claimant states, the two states which reserved a right to make a claim in the future, the United States and Soviet Union, and those with existing and substantial, for the time, research activities in Antarctica, South Africa, Belgium, and Japan. The mooted inclusion of Brazil, Poland, and India proved just simply too difficult, and they were not invited. Well, each invited state with alacrity accepted the invitation, and they then proceeded to meet and to draft and negotiate the treaty. The negotiations were, by today's standards, breathtakingly fast. The conference met over 6 weeks, and the treaty was adopted in 1959, coming into force 18 months later in June 1961. And it's a rather interesting phenomenon when one looks back, particularly as an international lawyer, at the structure, growing framework and structure of public international law, that in 1958, for 59, apart from the Antarctic Treaty, there were only two other agreements, the 58 Law of the Sea Convention and the creation of the International Atomic Energy Agency, that had been including all the major powers since the Second World War. So the Antarctic Treaty was a very significant achievement at a time of great tension and concern. But they were each agreements, the Law of the Sea Convention, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and the Antarctic Treaty, form part of the bare bones, really, of the modern structure of public international law as we understand it. Well, it's been said many times, and it's true, the Antarctic Treaty is disarmingly simple. I won't go through its terms because I'm sure you're all very familiar with it. But there are two elements of it that I would like to discuss very briefly. One is the concept of sovereign neutrality because it's so profoundly important, and the other is the constraint imposed by the treaty on the exercise of jurisdiction by contracting states over non-nationals. Firstly, then, to paraphrase, the Antarctic Treaty under Article 4 should not be interpreted as a renunciation of previously asserted rights or bases of claims, nor is the treaty to prejudice the position of any party as regards its recognition or non-recognition of any other state's right of claim or basis of a claim. Now, this is circumloquacious legal language, but it has been one of the most successful devices, techniques in law in the international dispute resolution field. Few such clauses have formed the foundation for so extensive a superstructure of interlinked treaties for the governance of so large a part of the world. Few such clauses have proved to be so successful in dispute resolution. While Marcot has described it as a purgatory of ambiguity, it has enabled each of the states to, often with diametrically inconsistent juridical positions, to engage cooperatively and fruitfully in the region. Not only does Article 4 enable states with differing legal perspectives to participate in the treaty, but it forms the glue for the subsequently negotiated interlinked agreements that now comprise the system as a whole. Parties to CAMELAR, for example, are bound by Article 4 of the Antarctic Treaty and their relations with each other, even though they may not all be parties to the Antarctic Treaty itself. It should, however, be remembered, I've always been a great fan of Article 4, not only because of what it achieved with the Antarctic Treaty system, but how it can also be useful in other boundary disputes, particularly straddling oil deposits in areas where boundaries are not resolved. But Arthur Watts did quite reasonably point out that the provision has never solved the sovereignty problem and that the national claims to sovereignty and the interest in Antarctica remain very much alive. Indeed, there are really no strategic reasons why claimants should relinquish their juridical positions so long as their central interests are protected. It remains, however, a trump card to be played wherever the Antarctic Treaty does not meet those interests as defined by states concerned. Now, the evolution of the treaty system, I think you know that you know the story. Initially, we had the agreed measures for the conservation of Antarctic flora and fauna in 1964, a code of conduct for human interference in the Antarctic environment in 1975, and a statement of accepted principles and good conduct guides for tourist groups. We then had the first separately negotiated treaty for particular legal reasons, and that was the Convention on the Conservation of Antarctic Seals in 1972, and then the Convention for the Conservation of Antarctic Marine Living Resources in 1980, which for the first time established some form of international organization with legal personality, headquarters, an executive secretary and staff, with a decision-making capacity based on consensus rather than the unanimity rule. So this was a very profound and important change. Much more controversial than marine resources was how to regulate minerals exploration and exploitation, and we saw then the development of the Convention on the Regulation of Antarctic Mineral Resource Activities, which, of course, as you know, didn't come into force and was immediately made redundant by the Madrid Protocol in 1991 and the establishment of the Committee for Environmental Protection. Well, finally, then, in terms of the evolution of the system, we have the Antarctic Treaty meeting in Stockholm in 2003 that created a permanent secretariat with headquarters in Buenos Aires, and that, given the historical background and the deep reluctance at any form of organizational structure, has been a very important step forward. But I'd like, if I may, finally, to mention a matter that is particular to the Australian region, or the waters of Antarctica, but which I think needs to be understood as a warning for what can happen if the Antarctic parties don't take up the cudgels of managing the area in a way that is seen as appropriate in the 21st century. And that concerns the Humane Society International action that was brought against a Japanese whaling company that had been whaling on whaling ship, that had been whaling in territory or seas that were claimed by Australia under its domestic legislation as part of its exclusive economic zone, and where an Australian whaling sanctuary had been declared. Entirely, of course, appropriate for Australian internal domestic law to adopt legislation of this kind, but a different matter entirely if an individual litigant attempts to use that legislation against a foreign national. And here we had an action in the federal court in Australia which was ultimately successful after an appeal to the full court of that court, in which the whaling was declared to be illegal and an injunction was issued restraining it from further whaling in those waters. The Australian government decided that it would not enforce that injunction, a very, very unusual phenomenon for most systems of law, and it declined to enforce it on the grounds that the Australian legislation should not be enforced against a non-national. Of course, Australia made that decision because it did not want, firstly, to override an arguably settled convention that whatever the ambiguities of Article 8 of the Antarctic Treaty might be, as a matter of practice, states would not assert their domestic legislation against non-nationals. So this was very much behind the Australian thinking. But, of course, the other analysis would be that it would be extremely dangerous to expose the weaknesses and strengths of the Australian position to international debate. So the matter was avoided. But my point is that where you have a domestic issue that creates great public concern, a state is going to find it increasingly difficult not to employ its own domestic legislation if the Antarctic Treaty parties themselves are not able to agree on mechanisms to meet these contemporary needs. There is an argument, and it has been made by the Paris, Sydney and Canberra working groups on whaling, that the Antarctic Treaty system has the legal capacity to consider the validity or otherwise of whaling. I won't comment on that other than to say that I think we're going to see issues of this kind arising much more frequently. Well, then, in conclusion, may I say that the Antarctic Treaty system has had a 50-year evolution of extraordinary success, but that the 21st century poses new, sensitive, and complex challenges to the authority of the regime. It might be suggested, for example, that the regime needs to collaborate more effectively with the many other international organizations that exist, and other speakers might refer to this later today. But obviously one could look at the International Maritime Organization, the UN's International Seabed Authority, the IUCN, the tour operators, the International Hydrographic Organization, and so on. There is some movement towards thematic regional cooperation in relation to Patagonian tooth fishing, the South Indian Ocean fishing arrangement, that suggests some positive move forward in the future. I think we're also going to see greater pressure in terms of energy security. The US Energy Information Administration reports that the Weddell and Ross Seas hold 50 billion barrels of oil, similar to Alaska's known reserves. It will not be surprising if the UN Continental Shelf Commission will one day be asked to consider the limits of the Antarctic Continental Shelf claim, and that is a very difficult and controversial matter that calls into question the meaning, again, of Article 4.2, although, in fact, Article 4.2, that's never been entirely clear. Tourism poses threats to the environment. And as you will know, a meeting takes place in New Zealand, I think, in the next few days to look at the risks and to ensure that the Antarctic Treaty system is in a position to manage the very significantly increasing numbers of seaborne tourism. There are also threats to security within the region. The point has been made very often in the past that the treaty system was arguably effective in confining the Falklands War to the sub-Antarctic region. But there are more and worrying elements, including the terrorist attack on Rainbow Warrior in New Zealand, the fire on the Nissin Maru of the Japanese fleet in 2007, and recent activities by the Sea Shepherd Group in respect of whaling. We might see greater levels of tension in the area, also posed by increasing levels of piracy in the sub-Antarctic region and the rising number of asylum seekers in the southern waters that pose search and rescue obligations. We might also be looking at economic opportunities from fishing, clean water and bioprospecting, and I imagine many of you will be raising issues as we go through the next day or so. So finally then, I'd suggest that some new thinking and initiatives are required to strengthen the system. It is under criticism for being somewhat non-transparent and unable to enforce its measures and recommendations and slow to respond to contemporary threats. So what are the solutions? Well, I think one, and a very obvious one, is to encourage as many other states as possible to come into the Antarctic Treaty system, because 46 states do not stand tall, really, in relation to 192, although it must be said that the major powers and major population groups are within the system. It might be that we can look at developing modest reform through legal change, adopting the concept of an Antarctic Treaty Commission for the Antarctic Treaty consultative parties, giving the chair rather more power to act than will be the case at the moment. It might also be possible for an independence performance review, such as happens within the Indian Ocean Tuna Commission. So I think that there are opportunities, and in final conclusion, I think that the goodwill, the clarity about the common values in relation to Antarctica, the excitement of the science, and the manifest need for us to understand Antarctica for the wider interests of managing climate change and other issues globally will give the Antarctic Treaty parties and members of the regime the confidence and the political will to develop a regime which has been extraordinarily successful. So along with you, I very much congratulate those of you who've helped to build this system and to confirm my own optimism that it will continue to be a leading model for the management of an environmental regime and regions beyond the limits of national jurisdiction for the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Gillian. I actually walked up to see whether the red light was flashing, and it was. So I'm going to cut down on your time in the panel as a result. But I have, however, the great pleasure of giving you now your numbered medal from the organizers, and thank you for your talk.